We start off, as we do every Friday, with the Federal News Countdown, and I am very pleased to introduce you to the lineup of excellent guests that we have, choosing the news stories that will count down on the countdown this week. First of all, welcome for the first time to the program, the new president of the National Academy of Public Administration, Dan Blair. It is great to see you.
Thank you, Francis. I appreciate being here.
Glad to have you on the program today. You've chosen great stories, and we'll talk to them in a moment. One of the board members at NAPA and a regular on the Federal News Countdown is Robert Shea, here today, and of Grant Thornton. It's good to see you again, sir.
Thanks for having me back.
Happy to do it. The way this works, if you've never heard of the Federal News Countdown before, is each of these gentlemen have chosen the news stories that they think are the most important to people who work for the federal government this week. They've ranked them in order from number 3 to number 1, and we will count them down in that exact order on the Federal News Countdown. So that means, of course, that we start with
number 3.
The third most important federal news story of the week, as chosen by Dan Blair, is from the Washington Post. The headline is NTEU President Colleen Kelly reelected to a fourth term after Eddie Walker, her opponent, said this time for sure he was going to knock her out. The margin of victory turned out to be 86-14, which probably wasn't what Mr. Walker had in mind, was it, Dan?
I think it's an amazing story, and that's why I picked it as my number 3 story.
Mm-hmm.
Last year, the environment for federal employees and the feds in general, in the federal community, it's been really rough. And between this rough environment, the change that was brought forth by the 2010 November elections, all of this environment was really tough for the federal employees. But moreover, it really said something about, you know, where are the unions in this, and what are the unions standing for, and how much clout do they have? And given that situation, plus the fact that NTU was in a death battle with AFGE over the TSA representation, which mm-hmm. they lost, could have spelled a really tough reelection environment for Colleen Kelly. But it didn't. She trounced her opponent with 86% of the vote.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's very, very telling.
Mr. Walker ran against her the last time she was up for election and was sure, in statements that he made before the election, that the loss of the TSA bargaining unit was going to be the difference for him. And I don't have the number in front of me, but I think he lost worse this time than he did last time. So what do you think that says about either her leadership or the overall importance of the TSA bargaining unit to NTEU long term?
Well, I think long term it was very important to NTEU to get the TSA employees. But what this says to me is that her membership says, let's stay the course,
mm-hmm.
that they aren't willing to risk, in this environment today, new leadership when they understand what they have before them, and that Colleen is well-known to the membership of NTU. She's been there for a long time, and this, to me, says that that membership is pleased with what's, you know, despite the setbacks, is generally pleased with her performance, and so that's why they gave her another term.
Dan Blair, story number 2 on the countdown is headline, NTEU President Colleen Kelly reelected fourth term. It's Joe Davidson's story in the Post, and you can find it online at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. Robert Shea, your story number 3 is also from the Post. It is headline, Treasury Internet push may speed $532 billion to U.S. vendors. What did you see here that is good news?
Okay, so it's not intuitive that electronic invoicing is the most important story, but it talks about a couple of things. One, this little effort is going to save $7 million a year at the Department of the Treasury. It may save $450 million a year if applied government-wide. But more importantly, it's just one example of what this little office at the Treasury, the Office of Financial Innovation and Transformation, is doing to improve and reduce, really, the financial management footprint throughout the government. The thought is much of what government agencies do is the same. And so if they can all share best practices, do it in a similar way, they can do it more efficiently, more effectively, they can save money. And in the case of invoicing, you're talking about not only getting money faster to the people we owe it to, but also using information technology to prevent improper payments mm-hmm. from going out. So I think this is just one harbinger of a bigger initiative to you know, finally make some headway in improving financial management across government.
You have just achieved something that nobody else has done in the history of this show. Nobody's used the word harbinger before. So congratulations on that. Nicely done there.
Thank you very much.
One thing this administration has made a policy is to try things like this one place and then replicate and scale it across government. Did you do similar things when you were at OMB when it came to management issues like this?
Well, we did. We especially in the program areas, you want to make sure that what intervention you're employing is proven effective before you really make everybody else adopt it. Mm-hmm. So it's a tried and true method of piloting and then proving and then implementing that I think is a good idea.
Initially, when you look at the number, the raw number, the $7 million a year relative to where we are, that's like me asking you to borrow 50 cents. But when you talk about scaling it across government, $500 million is pretty impressive if it can be indeed scaled to that level.
Right. Every agency is going to be living in an environment of constrained resources for as far as the eye can see. And initiatives like this can be used to find money where it otherwise didn't exist.
A real quick, a cultural question. Do you think most agencies are awake to that fact yet, that these are the kinds of things they're going to need to be thinking about, working on, and then implementing? Or are we? Do you think a lot of folks are still thinking in, you know, maybe 10 and 15 years ago terms that the money's always going to be there?
I was talking to Danny Werfel this week at OMB. He's the controller over there. And he said that in the past, when money's flowed more freely, that there's not been much willingness or eagerness by agencies to tackle some of these big efficiency initiatives. He sees quite a sea change now in this environment of scarcity. People are really stepping up to take, you know, improper payments, real property, what have you, much more seriously.
So that's a good sign.
I think so.
All right, Robert Shea's story number three in the countdown is from the Washington Post. The headline is Treasury Internet Push May Speed $532 billion to U.S. Vendors. You can find it and all of the stories on the Federal News Countdown as selected by Robert Shea and by Dan Blair at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. Story number two when we come back on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
The Medium Extended Air Defense System is covering new ground in air and missile defense. 8 times more ground to be exact. Which means it will protect more troops on the ground and keep more dollars in the budget. MEADS has the advanced capabilities and reliability that the 40-year-old Patriot system cannot provide. And it will cost half as much to man and maintain versus upgrading Patriot, which is already costing U.S. taxpayers billions of dollars. MEADS 360-degree coverage defends 8 times more area using fewer assets and has the lethality to defeat advanced threats by being more mobile and agile. Defending more, costing less. Only MEADS covers it all. For more information about the MEADS program, go to MEADS-AMD.com. That's MEADS-AMD.com.
Meeting mission goals through technology, brought to you by General Dynamics Information Technology.
NASA has released an iPad app designed to let everyday users access the space agency's knowledge about the Earth in a highly visual format. The Earth Visualization Explorer beams images, video, and information about NASA's latest Earth science research directly to users' tablets. NASA plans to update the app with new features twice a week. It was developed by a program at the Goddard Space Flight Center that focuses on bringing data to people who aren't scientists or engineers.
General Dynamics Information Technology is dedicated to providing the latest, highest quality information technology services and resources to help organizations meet their mission objectives. Large-scale IT systems and communications networks are the strategic and operational heart of defense, intelligence, civilian government, and private business. They require the expertise of a company that delivers results. General Dynamics Information Technology. Information technology and professional services. Go to GDIT.com to learn more. That's GDIT.com.
Here's Gus Hunt, Chief Technology Officer, CIA, on the Federal Executive Forum on Emerging Technologies, sponsored by Riverbed Technology.
It's an environment that has radically shifted how we deliver capabilities from as a reactive world to a proactive world, where we can truly be agile, responsive, and actually, as a government, deliver what has emerged in the outside world as what we call frictionless IT.
To listen to the whole program made possible by Trezza Media Group, log on to federalnewsradio.com.
How would you like to increase the productivity of your mobile and teleworkers? Now you can, through Riverbed. Their WAN optimization solutions empower mobile workers with high-performance access to email, files, and applications and keep them collaborating in real time. Challenges and delays in working remotely suddenly disappear, and you're complying with telework and COOP mandates. Free your mobile workers to work anywhere with Riverbed. Learn more at riverbed.com. That's R-I-V-E-R-B-E-D.com. Riverbed. Think fast.
I'm Amy Morris. Here's a look at Monday morning's Federal Drive. The National Security Agency is stepping up efforts to recruit the best and brightest. How does it plan to bring on more cyber experts when so many agencies are dealing with frozen budgets? And a progress report for you on E-Verify. What's next for the system? That and more Monday morning starting at 6 on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. For all the latest federal news, check us out, federalnewsradio.com.
Thanks for listening to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. On the Federal News Countdown this week, Robert Shea of Grant Thornton and Dan Blair of the National Academy of Public Administration choosing the stories we're counting down. And we are up to
number two.
Dan Blair's second most important federal news story of the week is actually the headline now, outdated. Postal Service, according to yesterday, proposing cutting 120,000 jobs is the headline from the Post yesterday, and pulling out of the health care plan. Our Ruben Gomez talking to the Postal Service today, and the total number they're shooting for now, Dan, is 220,000. They want to do 100,000 by attrition and 120 by actual cuts of people who are already there. The thing that people are starting to talk about today, and I wonder what your thoughts are from your time serving on the Postal
Regulatory Commission.
Thank you very much. The name escaped me for a moment. Is people are starting to talk about this could be a model for what other agencies try to do when it comes to dealing with some of the long-term things that the agencies have to deal with when it comes to especially the retirement system, not even so much the cuts.
Well, what the article that was in the Post today and on the online yesterday talks about is not only the potential layoffs, which they can't do right now. They're going to have to either have the unions who have those contracts agree to the layoffs, which would probably not occur, or they're going to have to go to Congress, and Congress is going to have to abrogate those contracts. And that's going to be a tough sell to Congress because we're talking jobs,
mm-hmm.
and in an environment where you have a 9% unemployment rate, is this the right thing to do? Now, 80% of the Postal Service's costs are labor-related, and that these labor costs have been in effect since the 1970s. They have binding arbitration. One arbitrator is built upon the work of the other arbitrator. But the bottom line, the Postal Service is really hurting right now. They're expected to lose up to $9 billion. And so given these extraordinary times, they're really taking extraordinary steps. It's not only just getting authority to do layoffs. It's also they want to pull their folks out of the Federal Employee Health Benefit Program. And that has implications not just for the Postal Service, but for all federal FEHBP enrollees as well.
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of questions that have to be answered before they would do that. What would happen to their retirees? Would they stay within the old FEHBP? Would the Postal Service continue to pay those premiums? How would they continue to pay those premiums? Would they tap into their retiree health benefit fund, or is this for future retirees? There are a lot of questions and details that would have to be worked out. But OPM, the Office of Personnel Management, will also be involved in this because they would want to make sure that their risk pool is not affected by that. Now, you're drawing out more than 1.1 million participants, mm-hmm. plus their families. And
yeah.
so you're reducing the risk pool of the FEHBP. But also, are you going to if you leave postal retirees in there, will this make the risk pool more susceptible? You know, will it increase the cost for that risk pool?
Mm-hmm.
So these are questions that they're going that clearly have to be asked, and the details of the plan have to be worked out before I think, as Congress would consider such a proposal. But it shows you that the Postal Service, their trend lines are not good.
Mm-hmm.
They're facing up to $9 billion shortfall this year. They are running out of cash. Are they going to face insolvency at the beginning of the fiscal year in October? Those are questions that have been on everyone's mind.
Mm-hmm.
Are they going to be able to pay? You know, paying their employees has been a priority for them. Are they going to be able to pay their contractors? And so these are issues that Congress will be wrestling with. They have a $5.6 billion retiree health benefit payment that's due to the federal government on September 30th. And as it stands right now, and as they've publicly said, they can't make that payment.
Mm-hmm.
So what's going to happen? And that's all part of the atmosphere in which this story of 120,000 jobs, 220,000 potential employees leaving either through attrition, layoffs, or buyouts, a combination thereof. But it's very serious times for the Postal Service and their attempt to redefine who they are and redefine their footprint for the American public.
Robert, this nobody can say that leadership the Postal Service isn't willing to really pull a big one to try to make something work over there. I mean, Patrick Donahoe and the other leadership of the Postal Service had to know that the unions were going to go ballistic over this. They had to know members of Congress will think this is far too radical, and yet they were willing to put this out there.
Right. According to the story, a workforce optimization paper, the one they're talking about,
mm-hmm.
acknowledges the extraordinary request to break its labor contracts.
Mm-hmm.
So it is not under any illusion that this is going to be easy, but this really exemplifies, I mean, you can't make up how complicated it will be for the Postal Service to get out of this jam. They are expected to be funded and perform like a private sector entity, but they're hamstrung by so many ties to this federal behemoth that it makes it extremely difficult for them to impose any cost savings measures. And I'll be very interested to see if traditional parochial behavior on the Hill even further hamstrings them, shutting down post offices, what have you. Always extremely politically difficult.
The reaction from the Hill, I think, has been notably reserved. Nobody on either side of the aisle has said this is bad or good. Senator Carper put a statement out today. He runs the subcommittee in the Homeland Security Committee that oversees the Postal Service, and he put out a statement saying we'll wait to see what the details are like. Congressman Issa on the Oversight Committee on the House side, Republican, said pretty much the same thing yesterday evening. We'll see what the details look like. But nobody, after seeing what's in these white papers, is saying, I don't think this will work, or I'm not sure these are good ideas. Does that mean anything, or is it really just too early to be able to try to divine this?
Well, it is August in Washington.
Which means nobody's here.
Right? I would caution
you. Congratulations to the Postal Service on their timing.
Absolutely. It is August in Washington, and really gauging the Hill reaction at this point may be somewhat premature. But I thought it was interesting what Senator Carper said, and that he wanted to look at fairness to employees, but also would this improve the efficiency for the Postal Service as well. So I think that was a very balanced statement that he put out.
Mm-hmm.
And Chairman Issa has his own postal reform bill out already. He's taken some, I thought, very dramatic steps of recommending his legislation would impose a control board on the Postal Service. So clearly the Hill is engaged, but to the extent that they're going to be able to move and reconcile various versions of any postal legislation before that drop-dead date of September 30th is going to be a real challenge.
Mm-hmm.
The bottom line, they want to close, they're reviewing, I think it's 3,500 or 3,700 facilities for closure. They want to realign their network, and they need to realign their network. I mean, we really have a postal infrastructure that was built for the 80s and not for 2011.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the challenge of how does the Postal Service reduce this nationwide footprint? Will Congress allow it go from 6 to 5 days? Will it allow them to close all these different post offices? Will it allow them to realign their facilities? And will it allow them to even engage in layoffs? These are big questions, and these are tough public policy questions that are lying at the feet of the congressional door.
What I think is interesting about the 6 to 5 day movement is I've already seen comments from Mr. Donahoe indicating that that might not be the end of it, that there might be moves to 4 days. He said, I believe it was Tuesday was the day that he said is a much lower volume day during the week. Maybe we could do away with Tuesday and go to 4 days a week. Are there other countries around the world that don't deliver?
The commission did an advisory opinion based on the Postal Service's proposal to go to 6 to 5 day. And there are other countries. Other countries mandate delivery 6 days a week. The question is, do we have sufficient volume today that justifies 6 day a week delivery? Do we have a system that can afford 6 day a week delivery?
Mm-hmm.
My personal opinion was that this is it really is a diminishment of the Postal Service brand to go to 6 to 5 day, because no other delivery, UPS and FedEx don't do 6 day a week delivery, but can we afford it?
Mm-hmm.
And I think at the end of the day, if the question is the Postal Service is going to remain self-sustainable, I think the Postal Service is going to have to be given that authority to make that decision.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't I see SaveYourPostOffice.com launch some up there, establish some website?
It's a blog from a guy up in New York State who wants to save his local post office.
But he's creating this venue for others who want to do the same to save theirs. It'll mm-hmm. be, I mean, it's just, it's very
tough
pickle.
It goes back to, you know, we want to see these cuts take place, but not in my backyard.
Yeah.
You know, these local post offices, the local communities are going to fight tooth and nail to keep them, because it's just not about the Postal Service there. It's about community identity.
That's right.
And the question is it up to the Postal Service and ratepayers to pay for that community identity?
I wonder if that dynamic in Congress, at least, wouldn't change if a key member on a committee, either House or Senate side, would come out and say, here's the list of ones in my district that would close, and I hate this idea, this stinks, but the reality of the numbers is such that I'm going to do whatever I can to try to sustain the post office for everybody and not just for these folks. And so, and then somebody comes up with some kind of plan where you try to help with job transitions or something like that to try to ease that blow. But that member essentially comes out and says, I hate to do it, but I'm going to get behind this, even though it's going to affect me and the people that elect me.
You know, that type of shared sacrifice is what defines leadership.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll have to see as this debate rages on. I think one of the key forcing mechanisms in this debate is how much money will the federal government actually have to give to the Postal Service over the next few years. And if this becomes a drain on the Treasury, or if Congress wants to cut it loose, those are things that they're going to have to decide on.
Dan Blair's story number 2 on the countdown this week is from the Washington Post. Postal Service proposes cutting 120,000 jobs and pulling out of the health care plan, and we have it posted at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth, as well as an update based on our conversation with the Postal Service just this morning on federalnewsradio.com. Coming up on In-Depth with Francis Rose on the Federal News Countdown, Robert Shea's selection for the second most important federal news story of the week. That's next on In-Depth with Francis Rose.
Policies issued by American General Life Insurance Company, Houston, Texas. Not available in all states. For details, visit matrixdirect.com.
Sometimes I worry about what would happen to my family if I lost my job. But I never really thought about what would happen to them if they lost me and I didn't have life insurance. My cousin's husband died, and now she might have to sell her house just to make ends meet. I don't ever want to put my wife through that. So I called Matrix Direct.
Hi, I'm Brent Langdon for Matrix Direct. We partnered with American General Life to find you their lowest rates on term life insurance products. If you're 40 years old and married, we could find you a $250,000 policy for less than $16 a month. Call now for a free, no-obligation quote. 1-800-588-5514.
I feel so much better now that I called.
It only takes 5 minutes to see how you could save up to 70%. Call now. 1-800-588-5514. 1-800-588-5514.
IBM's supercomputer Watson may make us feel inadequate on quiz shows, but our brains actually outperform even the most powerful computers in many respects. The human brain packs incredibly nimble learning and processing power into a relatively small space using tiny amounts of energy. Dewika Kazum of Stanford University says today's digital computers will never really compare for a wide variety of tasks.
If we do brain simulation in real time using powerful supercomputers, it will basically require a dedicated nuclear power plant.
Kazum is part of a team engineering devices that mimic the versatile signaling strengths, learning ability, and size of the connections between nerve cells in the brain.
We try to extend the capabilities of information technology beyond digital logic.
The devices may also give us a better understanding of our brains. For more, go to www.nae.edu/radio. With the National Academy of Engineering, Randy Atkins, Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Retirement is expensive. You may need 70 to 90% of your pre-retirement income just to maintain your current standard of living. So how do you protect the money you've already saved from market fluctuations? How do you make sure you won't run out of money? Hi, I'm Mark Tabron. We'll tackle these questions and more every Saturday morning at 10:30. Learn how to protect and grow your money with me, Mark Tabron, on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Can't wait till Saturday? Then call me today at 301-773-3923.
IBM's supercomputer Watson may make us feel inadequate on quiz shows, but our brains actually outperform even the most powerful computers in many respects. The human brain packs incredibly nimble learning and processing power into a relatively small space using tiny amounts of energy. Dwiga Kuzum of Stanford University says today's digital computers will never really compare for a wide variety of tasks.
If we do brain simulation in real time using powerful supercomputers, it will basically require a dedicated nuclear power plant.
Kuzum is part of a team engineering devices that mimic the versatile signaling strengths, learning ability, and size of the connections between nerve cells in the brain.
We try to extend the capabilities of information technology beyond digital logic.
The devices may also give us a better understanding of our brains. For more, go to www.nae.edu/radio. With the National Academy of Engineering, Randy Atkins, Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Attention all military, active duty, retired, and all authorized family members. Your Quantico Marine Corps Base Commissary is on the road and bringing your hard-earned commissary benefit directly to you. This on-site sale will take place at Fort AP Hill, August 18th and 19th. Come out and experience savings that average more than 30% on all your groceries. For more information, visit commissaries.com. And remember, your commissary, it's worth the trip.
Federal News Radio in a Web 2.0 world. Find Federal News Radio on Facebook and Twitter. Follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/FedNewsRadio or join the Federal News Radio group on Facebook. Chat with our team and make connections with others in the federal arena. Email us at fnrcomment@federalnewsradio.com. Visit our website, federalnewsradio.com. Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, your source for federal news now.
In Depth. We're back on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. The Federal News Countdown this week features the three most important federal news stories as chosen by Robert Shea and Dan Blair. And Robert Shea's story number two on the countdown is Jason Miller's story on federalnewsradio.com with the headline, HUD Finds Program Success in Review Sessions. HUD and Veterans Affairs reducing the number of homeless veterans by this program review that Jason wrote about. What did you like that you saw here, Robert?
Pretty hot stuff, huh?
What I do love about having you on the show is that you're a half-full guy.
Yeah.
You choose stories that demonstrate good things that are happening in government when a lot of people want to focus on the screw-ups.
I do have a theme. They're all positive stories, and this one I'm particularly excited about. We've got demonstrated results from a methodology that's being employed by Peter Grace over at HUD, where what they do is, it's not magic, they sit down with everybody who's responsible, look at the information, and they decide who's going to do what by when to improve results.
Mm-hmm.
And he says it's hard at first. You got to get the information right. You got to get the data right. You got to get all the right people at the table. But if you have a relentless focus, then over time you will see improvements, sometimes dramatic. They're 46% ahead of their goal to reduce homelessness among the nation's veterans. That's extremely worthy goal, and they're making real progress. So I did think it was worth a little shout-out. This methodology has been employed across government in a lot of arenas. You know about the TxDOT sessions?
Mm-hmm.
That this is modeled after that same methodology. Dan Tangerlini's doing it over at Treasury. This is... modeled after something Mayor Giuliani did in New York City, the CompStat program, where you get everybody, all the right players at the table. They focus on a particular issue of importance, be it crime, housing, education, and they say, how are we doing? Who's responsible? and let's employ strategies over time to see if they're working, and if not, do something different until it does work.
Mm-hmm.
So more power to the stat effort going on in government today.
Dan, there was a fear when Vivek Kundra started the tech stat sessions that they would turn into, not because of him necessarily, but just because of the nature of the process, that they would turn into finger pointing or browbeating. Why is this all screwed up? And everybody that I've talked to that's participated in one of those, and then later on some of these other ones, Robert mentioned the other places that these are being used, are saying the reason that they're working is because that's exactly not how they're being done. What do you see that you like in these?
Well, I see this story as a threefer. we have an agency that has positive results of meeting or exceeding their goals. That's rare, and that's good. That's a positive story. It's also it's a result of a good methodology that was employed, but moreover, it has some real-world results.
Mm-hmm.
And we can talk about goals and methodologies and meeting them and programs and plans to do this. But when you're going to reduce the number of homeless veterans by 59,000, you're halfway to meeting that goal, that has some real-world benefit.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this shows what government can do and do well and have a positive effect for the American people. I think it's a great story.
Jason writes something here, Robert, that you and I have talked about before in a variety of contexts. He writes, the biggest challenge in getting these sessions up and running is the quality of the data. That's really at the key of any of these kinds of measurements, isn't it?
It's really important, but you need not make the perfect enemy of the good.
Mm-hmm.
And, Peter Grace at HUD answers that question by saying it was real painful to get started, but we got started. And the data gets better and better every time as the demand for the data increases.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not that just the demand makes it better, but people will, by using it, notice flaws that need to be corrected. And so over time, you get more timely, complete, accurate data.
Mm-hmm. In your experience, both of you in government, have you seen instances where there was paralysis in getting started, where people said, well, we don't know if we're going to have the right information, the right data, if it's going to be clean enough or whatever, so we're just going to wait until we have that all in line? Because I would tend to agree with you that that leads to nothing ever really getting accomplished.
I see it right now. You know, the administration has been poised to launch performance.gov, on which they're to report performance data across government, but that remains in the development stages, and I think it's a function of waiting until it's perfect to launch.
Mm-hmm.
And
it's that waiting for the perfection that will never happen. It's like waiting for Godot, dude. It is not going to show up. And if you have something good, you have to have to shed your fear, because you have to put your name on the line and move forward.
Mm-hmm.
There's a great speech by Theodore Roosevelt about the man in the arena. And you know what? You have to put out the big ideas. You have to put out what you want to do and be subject to criticism, because if you don't put out what you believe in, then you're never going to make any accomplishments or move forward. So what my experience has always shown is that you take one step at a time. Don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good, but put out there what your proposals are, get the feedback, and move forward. And I'm real pleased with this story, though. Really makes, when I was at OPM, I coordinated our veterans outreach, and hearing the stories of the homeless veterans, people who have given up their life and limb for our country and coming back from the two wars, this is a really good feel-good story, and I'm glad to see that we're making results and producing something for the American public.
The voice that you hear there is Dan Blair. He's the new president of the National Academy of Public Administration, and he's talking about Robert Shea's number two story in the Federal News Countdown this week. The headline is HUD Finds Program Success in Review Sessions. It's Jason Miller's story on federalnewsradio.com, and you can find it there linked up on the in-depth page. We are up to the number one story of the week on the countdown, chosen by Dan Blair of Napa and Robert Shea of Grant Thornton. And we will hit on number one in just a moment on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
I'm like you. I watch the cherry blossoms bloom in the spring. I live amongst monuments and museums. I enjoy walks on the National Mall. Washington, D.C. is my home. This is where I found my career. I am a civilian employee of the United States Coast Guard. That's right, the Coast Guard. The Coast Guard provides me with great workplace training and excellent federal benefits. It allows me to live my life to the fullest. I have time off to travel and have flexible work hours so I can spend time with my family. Coast Guard gives me access to childcare, health and fitness programs, and first-class health insurance, life insurance, and retirement benefits. This is my career. It's how I serve. Find out more about U.S. Coast Guard positions available in D.C. and across the U.S. at CoastGuardCivilian.com/federal. That's CoastGuardCivilian.com/federal. The U.S. Coast Guard is an equal opportunity employer.
Quest Government Services is becoming CenturyLink. CenturyLink is positioned to support your mission objectives and provide you with an enhanced product and service portfolio. With our global reach, expanded nationwide network, and financial strength, we are linking IT leaders to a better future. Your link to the future begins here. One company, stronger connected. See the benefits of partnering with us at quest.com/federal. That's quest.com/federal.
Newsmakers, talk to Emily Kopp on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Robert Buggs is the Education Department's Chief Human Capital Officer.
We prioritize the position offerings. In other words, we may say all financial analysts first come, first serve may have a buyout. And if we don't exhaust that employee occupation, then we may go to another occupation.
Hear the entire interview online at federalnewsradio.com/federaldrive.
We're back on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. The Federal News Countdown this week features the three most important federal news stories of the week, as chosen by Robert Shea of Grant Thornton and Dan Blair of Napa. And we're up to
number one.
And the number one most important federal news story of the week is selected by Robert Shea. One of the reasons I love having you on the show, not only is it the half glass half full thing that I mentioned earlier, is you throw me a curve every once in a while. Your number one story this week is the Washington Post story. The headline is "Debt Crisis Sure, But a Good Day for Life's Tiny Joys." This is the print version of the Bobby McFerrin song "Don't Worry, Be Happy," isn't it?
It is. Let me read this. If one is willing to look hard enough, to go small enough, to recognize that people often don't measure life in Dow points but in tiny pleasures, extra cream, friendly dogs, pumpkin curry, then yesterday was an extremely good day in Washington. I think that was a ray of sunlight in a sea of darkness that we have to celebrate. I mean, look at the day we've got today in Washington. It's a beautiful day. I get to spend the afternoon with two good friends, Dan Blair and Francis Rose. Hopefully somebody's out there listening.
I'm sure someone is.
We're making them smile. It has been just a relentless drumbeat of bad news. And there is a lot of good going on. We live in the greatest country in the world, in one of the greatest cities in the world. So we ought to step back for a moment, take a deep breath, and say, it's not all bad.
What do you think, Dan?
I think that's what August is about. You know, apart from the 95 degree weather that we, or 100 degree weather we were experiencing, it is a beautiful day out there. And this story is great because it does allow you to think, you know, if you look at the cup, it's not half empty, it's half full. So
see, I knew no one could argue with this.
It's an optimistic way of looking at life's little pleasures. And I think that it brings a smile to my face as well, twinkle to my eye.
I don't know what to say. I think for the first time in the history of the Federal News Countdown, I'm speechless.
See, because we're too used to digging into the details of what's going wrong and not enough time talking about what's good. I really do think we have a lot to celebrate. I think folks are working real hard in this government to solve big problems, and they're making headway every day. I was at a meeting over at one agency today where they brought, it must have been 100 people in the room, all from different walks of life, federal, state, local, trying to figure out how they could all work better together to improve the plight of disconnected youth throughout the country. And what they said was, we got less money. We need to figure out how to reduce the burdens the government places on people so that they can access money to begin to solve real problems. I mean, that was a pretty inspiring meeting. They all recognize how difficult the challenges are, but are focused on the positive. How are we going to make a difference?
Why do you think, Dan, it's so easy for us to pay attention to all the bad stuff going on?
Well, look at what's in the news every day. You look at the front page of the Post. You turn on the Today Show in the morning. You listen to the news at night. And it's this constant, steady drumbeat of bad news, bad news, bad news. You look at what's happening in the stock market. You look at all these things and you wonder, wow, you know, is it really that bad? And it just creates a national funk, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And reading things like this help bring you out of it. You can't lead your life with rose-colored glasses on, but at least you can know that there are positive things going on, and it gives you an opportunity to start building on these things one step at a time.
Robert Chase, number one story of the week is from the Post. The headline is Debt Crisis Sure, But a Good Day for Life's Tiny Joys. And you will feel better about life and think about things that are going on in your world that are pretty good after you read this. So I encourage you to go to federalnewsradio.com/in-depth and do so. The number one story of the week is chosen by Dan Blair. It's next on the Federal News Countdown on In Depth with Francis Rose. We'll be right back.
This is NIH Health Matters. I'm Joe Belinfi. Researchers have discovered that the ability to estimate quantities is impaired in children who have a math learning disability. Dr. Kathy Mann Koepke, a staff scientist at NIH, says the findings suggest that students may struggle with math for very different reasons.
Children with math learning disability had significantly higher number discrimination and number identification or number mapping scores.
The link between difficulty estimating quantities and math difficulties was seen only in children who had a math learning disability and not in those who did poorly in math but were not considered to be learning disabled. For details, visit www.nichd.nih.gov. Health Matters is produced by the National Institutes of Health, part of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
Meeting mission goals through technology, brought to you by General Dynamics Information Technology.
The Navy and Marine Corps want to explore ways to lower their IT costs by partnering with the private sector on data center consolidation. They're asking industry for ideas on how the joint data centers could shrink the 80 centers the Department of the Navy operates now all around the world into a more rational footprint while still maintaining high availability and performance. The department has been told to cut its costs for business information technology systems by 25%.
General Dynamics Information Technology is dedicated to providing the latest, highest quality information technology services and resources to help organizations meet their mission objectives. Large-scale IT systems and communications networks are the strategic and operational heart of defense, intelligence, civilian government, and private business. They require the expertise of a company that delivers results. General Dynamics Information Technology, information technology and professional services. Go to GDIT.com to learn more. That's GDIT.com.
Since 1886, the Boys and Girls Clubs of Greater Washington, D.C. has been helping children in D.C., Maryland, and Virginia. Now they are visited by over 3,000 children every day. The club teaches character and leadership development and arts education. No child is turned away for being unable to pay the $25 fee, and the club needs your help to make this happen. Give a gift online at bgcgw.org. The life you lift up today will be the life that brings a better world tomorrow. This message is brought to you by GEICO and Federal News Radio.
Why do I serve in the U.S. Navy?
For freedom.
Freedom of religion.
What America stands for.
Why do I serve in the U.S. Navy? For honor.
Everybody. And watch out for everybody.
Freedom to vote.
Democracy.
Freedom to go outside and play with my kids.
I joined the Navy to serve my country.
Every freedom that we have.
The right to raise our kids in peace.
My little brother.
My wife.
My kids.
Our children's children.
The United States Navy.
It's not for ourselves alone that we serve.
It's the Federal News Countdown on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. And the number one story of the week, as selected by Dan Blair, the new president of the National Academy of Public Administration, is headlined, "No Pay and Benefits Cuts for Now." It's Steve Losey's story in the Federal Times. And I guess the thing that has everybody on edge right now, Dan, is that "for now" qualifier at the end of that headline, isn't it?
Well, it is the qualifier. And after Robert's positive upbeat story, I feel like I'm the Grim Reaper by bringing us back down by saying, you know, this is the reality. That's true. The debt deal did not do any benefit cuts, but it set up the super committee and also set up a sequestration that will be taking place in the future if the if this new super committee can't come up with a deal. So this is an evolving story, and it's going to be worth watching because the committees are going to have to come up with some very difficult and painful cuts. And what those are going to be, I'm not sure, but we do already have an idea of what they might look like. We've had proposals in the House of making it those employees covered under the federal employee retirement system pay more for their pension.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen proposals floated, not legislatively, but through the media and otherwise, taking away that FERS benefit altogether for new employees. What's going to happen to the thrift savings plan? Are we going to continue this match for people saving for their retirement? What's going to happen with the federal employee health benefit system? What's going to happen with retirees? What's going to happen with pay in the future? And right now we have 9+% employment. But what happens when the economy comes back? What happens if will the federal government be in a position to recruit and retain employees? In the past, when we went through this somewhat in the 1990s, and government shed about 250,000 employees through a combination of some, I think, limited RIFs, but mostly through buyouts and early outs. And what we saw after that was that agencies offered these across the board. They weren't just strategic in who they went to. And so you had the most marketable employees who said, "I'll take this buyout and go work for a contractor or for a company or in the private sector," or people who are about to retire said, "Well, this is the incentive for me to get off the mm-hmm. rolls." And so you had the people who were most marketable or had the most knowledge stay, and you had agencies who were left anorexic in terms of people with proper skills to get the job done.
Mm-hmm.
So the glass message here is agencies need to start preparing today for these cuts that are going to take place. And how are they going to do that? And what kind of strategies are they going to employ?
Mm-hmm.
Do they understand do they have the tools available? And do they have the assistance available to go through and say, "Look, we have this mission that we have to accomplish. The law requires us to do this, A, B, C, and D. And by regulation, we have to do 1, 2, and 3. But by practice, we do all whole sorts of other things." And they're going to have to triage this and come back and say, "Look, if you want us to do something and do something well, we can't do the sum total of work that we're doing today.
Mm-hmm.
We need to reduce that work."
Yeah.
So that's the planning that needs to take place in anticipation of this. But it's going to be a very bumpy ride over the next year, year and a half for the feds.
I've talked about that a lot of times on the show with a lot of different people because I've kind of branded it right-sizing the mission, because we've talked about, some members of Congress have said, we need to right-size the government, we need to right-size the workforce, but nobody's talked about, okay, if we're going to have two-thirds of the budget and two-thirds of the people, then which third of the mission are we not going to do?
You're exactly right. I've been calling it a strategic realignment,
mm-hmm.
because you can't do everything you're doing today if your resources are cut substantially.
Mm-hmm.
And if you try to do everything you're doing today, it's a prescription for disaster. You
yep.
won't be able to get anything done. So if government's going to perform, and everyone expects government to perform, we need to now start helping agencies and the federal government prepare for this and decide what they need to do, to give them the tools to do it well. But the things that maybe that they don't do so well or they don't need to do, they need to shed those. Maybe other agencies are already doing that. Maybe there's already duplication.
Dan's talking, Robert, about what some people have called the brain drain, and we're reporting that one of the latest organizations to talk about early outs and buyouts is the Government Accountability Office. General Dodaro specified, though, in the memo that he sent, that SES people and other senior executives there, senior leadership, aren't qualify. They're not going to be offered a chance at an early retirement or buyout specifically because they want to keep that level of leadership there. Do you think that might be something, a model that we see more of as agencies try to do reductions in force?
GAO has been a leader in human capital management. It's a much smaller agency than most, so it's easier to do there. But they have employed a much more strategic method of downsizing. I want to take issue with your point about mission. I don't think we need to adjust our mission or the kinds of things we're trying to solve to reduce the size of government. If you look at how much duplication there is, we can continue to do the same thing, probably with a lot fewer resources. My problem is that, and like you say, Dan, I think agencies could really take the lead here in employing these inevitable cuts in a much more strategic fashion. Unfortunately, I haven't seen that leadership. They're talking about across-the-board pay freezes, which not only disincentivize people to work for government, but it doesn't save any money.
Well, if you say, for instance, the super committee that was formed by way of the debt deal isn't able to come to some kind of resolution, then sequestration goes into effect along the lines of the old Graham Hollings-Rudman Act that was passed back in the 80s. And this may mean furloughs for employees. It may mean pay freezes, pay cuts, how agencies are going to manage this. But agencies now have an opportunity to look at what their missions are. And I'm not saying reduce your mission, but what happens if your mission is the same thing as another agency's? These are ways in which you can come together strategically to say, if you do X, I'll do Y. We don't need to duplicate the same effort.
Mm-hmm. Reduction in duplication can get you a long way towards enhancing mission achievement while at the same time reducing overall costs.
But we need to decide what government needs to do. If you're going to have an office of 150 and it's being reduced to 120, we need to decide what that office is going to do. It can't do the same work in the same way that it was doing before because that's a prescription for failure.
And when you say we, who's we? Who is it that makes those decisions?
I think that the federal government will have to step up. The executive branch is going to have to exert and exercise leadership in this area. And Congress is going to have to exercise leadership in this area, too. Agencies have a number of tools available to them now. Through buyouts and early outs, they can strategically focus these on groups of employees rather than offering them across the board. But more needs to be done in terms of planning, and that's where the agencies come in.
Dan Blair, story number one in the Federal News Countdowns from the Federal Times. The headline is No Pay and Benefits Cuts for Now, and it's linked up at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. Robert, a terrific job as always. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Francis.
A terrific maiden voyage for you, Dan. And the only problem with your performance today is since it was good, I'm going to make you do it again.
Oh, Francis, don't tell me that. Don't tell me that.
Thank you very much. Congratulations on your new job at NAPA.
Well, thank you. I'm looking forward to it. I miss my former colleagues at the Regulatory Commission, but this has been a tremendous opportunity, and I'm looking forward to working with the fellows at NAPA and doing some really good work, because that's what the Academy is there to do.
Great to have you on the show. Thank you again, Robert.